Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about The Monkey for sure, as we teased last week, and maybe a few other things. So you watched a movie that you told me to watch called The Gorge that's on Apple Plus.
Oh, okay. So did you watch it?
I tried to watch it. Uh-oh. So I wanted to hear... I want to go back and sit down and really focus on it. But, man, I watched like 20 minutes of it, and I was so bored. But apparently you have to get past, like a lot of stuff to get to, like, oh, like, the last half of the movie. It's like a totally separate movie.
So, the first half is very much like, okay, so, like, the first 10 or 15, as soon as they get to the gorge... just stay with it, like, because it's very kind of, like I said, it's not a, it's a movie of two separate halves, right? Like, it's, the first half is a very kind of, like, it's essentially like a romance. The first half is that. The second half is very much so an action movie. I happen to really liked the romance. Like, I didn't, like I said, it's a B movie, right? But there's a lot to it that I liked, and I should have warned you, like, the first 10 or 15 minutes, because it's a lot of, like, navel-gazing, I guess you could say. Like, you know,
yeah.
Two characters that are, like, snipers, and they're questioning their like, you know, their lives as snipers, or, like, as a government contract assassins. But as soon as, like, Miles Teller jumps out of the plane, you're set. Like, so you did you get to that point, or did you get beyond that and you were just like, it's not for me?
Ripley, stop. Sorry. Hey, there's nobody there. So she's losing her mind over nothing. I don't think I made it to him jumping out of the plane.
Oh, so you didn't even get to Sigourney Weaver.
No, I did see Sigourney Weaver.
Okay, so you were just about to you were just at the threshold. So you basically, you met Anya Taylor-Joy, you met her father, like, the whole suicide thing, and then you got to Sigourney Weaver, and then, like, you didn't get to the jump on the plane, like, where he jumps off the plane.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think I turned it off right after Sigourney Weaver, and I was like, oh my God, man. Like, I thought they were going to be, like, garden... Like, I thought we were just going to have, like, monsters and, like, given who it is, like, who wrote it, who directed it, like, and I get, like, listen, so I listened to the film cast and they were talking about it, and it's funny, Dave and Jeff were, Dave was like, oh, this was a lot, I had a lot of fun with this movie, and Jeff was like, this movie is stupid. It's terrible. Like,
that sounds like, you know what? Like, I'm more in line with Dave's, like, thought process. So that makes sense to me. That, like, literally makes sense.
So, and hearing them talk about it, I was like, I didn't go far enough. Like, no. I was sitting there watching it, and I was just like, I kept checking my phone. I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, the movie's not pulling me in, so maybe I'm... And then later I heard that little review that they did. I was like, oh yeah, I just didn't get far enough. So I may try to go back and watch it this week, if I can make the time for it. But yeah, I wanted to like just talk about it briefly, because I did try to watch it, and it does definitely, like, on the surface, I'm like, oh, this is something I will like. Miles Teller, Anya Taylor-Joy, both really like them, and you've got Scott Derrickson and I just drew a blank on his name.
Cargill?
Yeah, Cargill. Yeah. creative behind it. And yeah, this is something I should definitely be into. And I just, for whatever reason, it just wasn't grabbing me. So, but it's like, very, very slow. Like, that beginning was really slow.
Yeah, it's very kind of, like I said, it's of a piece. Like, if you think about it, like, that's kind of like the way that a 90s movie starts, right? Like, like a mid-90s movie that would have been released in the spring. It starts off with, like, character, because they don't have the budget. They front-load it to get you, like, character. And then they do the thing, right?
Yeah.
And again, like I'm very, like, this is a very mid film, right? I enjoyed it, but it's a mid, like I said, like, it's a mid film. Like, it's not a, it's a very much so a 3 to 3.5 star film if we're doing, like, a review. I don't normally do those kinds of, like, numbers and, like, gratings, but it's definitely a solid B, right? Like, it's excellently made, it's beautifully shot, but you have to, like, I should have warned you that, yeah, it is definitely front-loaded. That first 30 minutes is 30 minutes. Like, it's 30 minutes of character build. So, like, you know, the whole thing of, like, people saying, like, something like, what do they call it? Like, a slow burn? Like, that's definitely what it is. But then once it gets to where it goes, like, it's on fire. So maybe, yeah. Maybe try it. Maybe not. I mean, you know, we'll see. But I'm glad you tried. It's interesting that the film cast had actually talked about it. And, like, you know, like I said, like, the older I get, the more I'm in line with Dave Chen's, like his thoughts on films more than anybody else on that show or that shows up on that show. So it's very surprising to me, but, like, it's not surprising to me that he enjoyed it. So, but yeah. Did you watch anything else? Because I've watched some stuff.
So, I'm trying to think of anything I may have. No, not that I can think of. Nothing beyond the, like, stuff I normally. There's a show I wanted to get to on, I think it's on Prime. It's called Clean Slate.
Yes, with Laverne Cox and by our favorite who's still, like, how the hell is he still making shows? Like, isn't he, like, 98 now?
Norman Lear, yeah, he's damn near approaching 100. So
yeah, like, good God, I have that earmarked. Maybe I'll try to make time for it this week to watch it. Because that's definitely something I was looking at. I was going to hit you with two things.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was born in... Oh, no. So... Oh, Norman Lear, he passed away. How was his name on the credits and he passed away?
Because it's... it was a show he was developing earlier. Like, I had heard about this show for a while. This was made around the end of 2023, the beginning of 2024, and it's had nothing but trouble with getting, like, first it was supposed to be on Netflix, and then it wasn't because of the concept of it, and then it floated around for a while because it was made at Sony, because that, like, you know, Columbia was his home, and they finally found a place for it on Prime, because, like, this was supposed to come out, like, at the beginning of 2024.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, given our current climate, like, it definitely feels like the right time, although I feel like it's not going to get the push that maybe it would have gotten in previous years. We don't want to talk about it kind of thing. Like, it's there, but we're not going to promote it, so...
yeah. I wonder if critics, because I heard it through a couple of critics.
So, like, I mean, the trailer looked really funny. So
yeah, it did. Like, it really, like, it looks like, that's what interested me, was the trailer, was this whole thing of, like, a football player that transitions, and like, just the trailer was, like, the right kind of funny that I was like, okay, I can see this. Like, I'm going to give this a chance. I just hadn't gotten around to it.
And George Wallace is just, he's so good at doing the George Wallace thing. Did I ever tell you I met him?
No, you never told me that.
So it was back when I was delivering pizzas, and I was delivering a pizza to a hotel, and he was playing, like he was doing his stand-up, like at our local arena. It's, well, I mean, I say arena, it's not that big, but it's where the hockey team played and the indoor football league played. So it's a decent sized venue. And he was playing there, and he was staying at the hotel that I was delivering to. And he was at the front desk as I walked up and talking to the desk, the lady behind the front desk. And for what the hotel, for whatever reason, we had to check in with the desk before we went to the rooms they wanted us to. It was whatever. It wasn't even really like this, like hoity-toity hotel. It was literally just a basic hotel chain, but maybe they'd had some trouble. And anyway, so I was standing at the front desk waiting on her to tell her, like, hey, you know, tell room such and such, I'm down here. And she walked away because I guess she was doing something for him. And I didn't know who it was. Like, so I'm standing there, and he looks, he turns around and looks at me. And he was like, that's not for me, is it? I was like, oh, shit. I was like, no, sir, it doesn't say George Wallace on it.
Oh, shit. That's
and I was like, I think you're hysterical. I know you hear that all the time, man. But, like, wow. So it was very, very brief. But, like, he seemed really, you know, nice. Like, I mean, I know he's not Tom Cruise or, you know, some global superstar, but, you know, he was not, he was being very cordial to the lady behind the desk. And it, you know, I see, when I was doing that, I would see people that weren't celebrities, you know, being shitty to, it's just the world we live in. So, he seemed like a really nice guy. He made a you know, very small joke, and it was, you know, 15 seconds of my life that I'll never forget where I met George Wallace. So, but yeah, like, I do really, really enjoy him, and like, this was not on my radar at all, and I don't even remember how, The app I used to watch all the TV I track, it has a feature that's like shows released in whatever month you're in. And it'll show you like either new episodes of shows that just started or new shows. And I will, when I'm bored, scroll through it and be like, see if there's anything that I don't know about that might strike my fancy. And I was like, what is this? I was like, oh, Laverne Cox, like she was great in Orange is the New Black. What is George Wallace? What is it? I went and watched the trailer and I was like, what the hell is this show, man? Norman Lear? Like, okay. Yeah. And I added it to my list and I just hadn't made time for it this week. So,
okay.
But speaking of Prime, I can't remember if we already talked about this, but
I'm fairly sure I know what you're going to say. But,
Our favorite show from the now defunct. What was it called? Freebie? Whatever. Freebie, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is returning, and they've already filmed all of season two.
That's what I've heard. A pleasant, like, so there's a lot of shit going on with Amazon that I'm just like, oh god.
Oh, do you want to talk about the Bond thing?
Yeah, let's talk about the Bond thing. You know what? I don't even want to talk about the returning of the show. We'll get to it once it's released.
Yeah, like, Jury Duty season two coming this year. Like, I briefly read what it was about, but yeah, it'll be something we definitely talk about.
Yeah, let's talk about the, like, okay, so as much as anybody hates the Broccolis, and I do, and I'm one of the people that like is a very first in line of like, fuck you guys.
They've certainly been a little too precious with a property that I agree deserves to be treated preciously, but like, it's not as precious as you think it is. And they do seem like a shitty bunch of people.
Yes. So. I mean, like in the 90s when, okay, like I'll give you a story. There was this story going around that after Independence Day, that Emmerich and Devlin, whatever you want to call them, Devlin and Emmerich, who were the biggest things in town, all they wanted to do was make a huge, giant James Bond movie. And this was at the time that Pierce Brosnan was Bond, and they wanted to make a giant ass James Bond movie with Pierce Brosnan. And the Broccolis were like, "No, we're cool. Fuck you." And I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me?"
Like, they just made at the time they had just made the biggest movie in the world.
In the world, like that movie was like, I mean, I know that like most people, like, because it's like it was 30 years ago, most people did not realize the kind of impact that movie had, but that was a huge, huge, huge movie. I mean, it was like it was the first movie, and no other movie ever did it. Was that weekend it played 24/7,
yeah.
24/7 to accommodate people. Like, we saw it at midnight on July 4th, like July 3rd into July 4th. And then, because I was 18, we saw it at our local theater. And then it blew us away so big that we wanted to go see it at the biggest, like one of the bigger theaters. And so we went to Universal City Walk. And we ended up at a 6 a.m. showing in the biggest screen, 6 a.m. And it was packed. Like, that's how big that movie was. And he said no to these fucking people. The Broccoli said no, thanks, we're good. Because they wanted to keep control. And, like, I'm very understanding of that, right? Like, wanting to keep the brand undiluted. But you went from, you went undiluted to, you gave it to Amazon? These motherfuckers are going to turn it into, like, they're going to have like 35 series that no one's going to fucking know about, but it's going to be about like the origins of Q, the origins of M, like James Bond Jr. Like, it's going to be fucking ridiculous. It's the stupidest thing in a long lines of stupid things. Like, the biggest one being they turned down Steven Spielberg. The second one being they turned down Emmerich. Like this goes to the top. Because it's like literally like I was talking to somebody about it. I was like, well, you know, like, it was a good run, like 55 years, close to 60 years of pure films, and getting, like, you know, getting it right, like at the end with Daniel Craig, like really truly getting it right and getting a series of films, regardless of some of the qualities of them, but like actually doing a 6-film arc where he gets an ending. That kind of is almost perfect, right? Like, so it's like, I'm going to be one of those guys that just says, it was good for me, now it's shit. Like, you kind of ruined the brand. I already know they're going to ruin the brand. And isn't it ironic that literally a James Bond villain took over James Bond?
I mean, it's kind of bizarre. It's like...
Yeah, right?
It is this meta thing of like, oh, he was actually the villain the whole time, and... Now he can finally end Bond, you know. It's like this weird version. It's like the James Bond version of Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Exactly. No.
It's like,
exactly,
oh my God, this is happening in the real world.
Yeah, don't give anybody ideas, right? You know.
And then his first thing is to try to crowdsource who should play James Bond. Are you fucking kidding me, man?
You know who they're going to end up with? Mr. Beast. That's who they're going to fucking end up with. Fuck you guys. Like, seriously, you suck a dick. Like, that's all I have to say about it. Suck a dick. Like I said, it was a good run. Like, I'm actually, this year, it's so ironic that they did. I'm like, well, this ruins it. I was working on a bigger piece for this year I was hoping to get it to 7-7 because, you know, double sevens. Yeah. I'm rewatching all of the Bond films because I have them on disc and stuff. So I've been going through, and there are like quite a few that I've not seen, right? Like Roger Moore's run. Like, I literally, there's like 5 of his 8 films that I've not seen. So I'm going through them and I'm just kind of like reviewing them, and like, I'm going to rank them. I'm going to talk about them. Like, I'm going to do a whole shebang in the month of July, but that's off the charts now. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to give these fuckers any more. Like, I'm going to continue to watch them because I'm finding a lot of joy in watching it. But the writing project is done. As soon as I saw this, I was like, well, there goes my writing project for July. Yeah. Because it's just, I'm not going to, like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, you know that you're in the dumbest fucking timeline, right? You know if you do something like this, they're going to do something stupid. They're gonna get AI to fucking boost it to get like literally Logan Paul or Mr. Beast or Kai Cent, whoever the fucking stupid fucking idiot that's out there that does stupid fucking things to play James Bond. It's not gonna be anybody worthy.
The only thing I think you might could point to, but even like some Tolkien people don't really love it, is their Lord of the Rings project. While it doesn't have the viewership that like Game of Thrones has, it does seem to take what they're tackling seriously. But Bond is such a bigger thing it's a lot of, and I didn't even see the last Bond movie. Like I just never got around to Bond is not my, like, I like it, but I'm not, I don't love it, you know?
Yeah.
So
I'm very of like what two halves of minds. Like, my thing is like, you know what? Like, the shit that hit me hard was Mission Impossible, and it continues. Like if you want to do it, like, you know, like Mission Impossible is like to the current era what James Bond used to be. Like, Bond has come close, right? Like, I will say that, okay, like, I love Bond, right? Like, I grew up with him. Like, my dad, like, me and my dad disagree on things. Like, his Bond is Roger Moore, you know, and Sean Connery. Mine is, like, Connery and Daniel Craig, right? Like, with a spreading of all the other guys. Pierce Brosnan is great. He was the first Bond that I saw. But the thing is that, like, okay, so, like,
better movies, that's for sure.
Yeah. But it's so weird because it's like Casino Royale is probably, if you twisted my arm and I had to say something of the 2000s, it might be the best action movie of the 2000s because it's the one Bond film. They got everything right. It's big. It's got character. It's brokenhearted. It's an origin story on the level of Batman Begins, where I think it's better than Batman Begins because it gets everything right. Like, and like, I would say of the 2000s, like from 2000 to 2010, if you were to twist my arm, I'd say it probably is the best action film. Now, when you get into the 2010s and 2020s, I mean, that's like, you know me, it's obvious it's Fury Road. And they're two very different films, but at the same time, like, I could say that about the Bond films, but like, it consistency, like, Mission Impossible is the thing for me if you're talking spy adventure shit. But it just, I don't know, man, like, I'm very sad about this. Like, it's like me and my wife constantly talk about being in the worst timeline. It's like, this is the worst timeline. Like, how do you give James Bond the fucking to this bozo? How? Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I have nothing. Like, give it to Netflix. At least Sardos, like, actually, he's doing stuff to actually, like, he actually cares about, like, making content and good content. It may not be the best content, but at least he cares, right? Like, and I know that you said the thing about Lord of the Rings, but here's the thing about Lord of the Rings is that it's still a joint venture between Weta and, like, you know, like the Peter Jackson conclave of, like, you know, artisans at Weta, and Christopher Tolkien and his group have a fucking iron fist on that shit. So they have they dictate terms the way that what's her name does. Hater. I'm not going to even mention her name on our podcast for Potter. Like,
yeah.
So this is them. Like, they kind of retain, they retain money control. Like, they make money off of it. Right. But they gave the keys to the car to fucking him, to fucking to this fucking stupidity. So it's not this, it's kind of the same, but it's not. The reason why the quality is so good with the Lord of the Rings, from everything I've heard from Tolkien heads, is because Jackson still cares, even though he has minimal and he has to go through Tolkien, like through the Tolkien estate with like, you know, the specific, like the Tolkiens. But then Tolkien like really cares about this shit and doesn't want to dilute the brand. And he's like a TV show and that's it right now. Like, you know, and occasionally films, like, you know, like we'll do some film stuff. But I mean, even like the animated thing that they did was still like high quality and good. Like I watched it. I didn't like it. It wasn't for me because it was like, here's the thing. Even I'm an anime fan. And that one was kind of like, like maybe you should have done this as a live action movie. Right. But I know why you didn't do it, because you couldn't invest the $300 million that it would have taken.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, like ultimately I'm like, what? Fuck you. Seriously, just fuck you. Okay, fine. And it's like, it's weird because it's like, have we come to the point in fandom where we have to like just say goodbye to our things that we like and try to find new things?
I mean, it does feel that way sometimes, but like, you know, there's still so much other stuff. Like,
yeah,
it sucks that we're probably at the end of like good James Bond movies. Time will tell. 2 years from now, we could be like, hey, we were wrong. This is fucking great, man. But yeah, you know, we've got at least one more Mission Impossible movie. If Tom Cruise really isn't going to hand that franchise off and he's going to keep doing it till he dies, then, you know, maybe we'll have more. Those are always at least entertaining. You know, it really does feel like that spectacle action movie thing is, I don't want to say dead, because like we have a chance to have that with like the comic book movies. But those are so superhero-y that, like, I really hate that Captain America, like, not going back to it, but we both did mostly enjoy it. Like, I did really enjoy it. But when you look at something like Winter Soldier, it's like, yeah, it doesn't hold a candle to Winter Soldier, man. And we're not getting movies like that.
No, we're not. We're really not. But you know,
a Rami Malek movie looks good though.
Yeah, it does. And maybe that's just like we've talked about before. Like I feel like they've done. Okay, so like I'm just gonna say this because it's not a pejorative statement, but it's actually a real statement. Like tech bros are the fucking worst, and they're the ones that ruined the music industry. Now the music industry needed to be burned down and rebuilt, and they are in the process of doing the same thing, which is burning down film. Like they don't have any idea of what it takes to be creative, because they're number crunchers. And so like there's this tenuous thing where they decide that they want to take it, they make it their own toy set, and then they ruin it, and then they go, it's like the Toy Story dream, I don't want to play with you anymore, and then they throw it away. Their next one's going to be video games. Like, I already know, because the video game industry makes way too much fucking money for them not to try to take a stranglehold on that. They're already leaving. We can see it. We can see the writing is on the wall. They are leaving this industry, and they're leaving it decimated. But what that does is that resets, because films. Okay, so like, yeah, you know, every once in a while, like, you know, the Emmerichs and the Camerons of the world had, like, you know, should be making, you know, billion-dollar movies, right? Or like $100 million movies back in the day, right? Like, they're like people that are physically responsible. Like, there should not be like every single movie should be $100 million investment, right? It just like it got bloat, and maybe this is the way, like in the music industry, how they went from bloat to like economy, and then they figured out their way. Hopefully, once these tech fucks leave, there's going to be an understanding of how to do this, because the blueprint is there. There are movies out there that like can do it, not on the cheap, but do it economically in such a way that you're not like, you're not sitting there going, oh, this is a CGI fest with a bunch of actors that I don't care about. And maybe that's what we need. Maybe we need to go back to that, you know, like, I just started Sonic last night, and I started to fall asleep. Like, I like, it wasn't anything to do with the quality of the film. It was too late. And so like I stopped at 20 minutes in, because I'd only watched maybe 5 of the 20 minutes. But the thing that I noticed was that they were smart about where they put their money. Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's a movie that only cost $120 million, but it looks like a movie that cost 2 times that. Even in the opening 20 minutes, I was very impressed. But it's smart filmmaking, and we're going to be talking about a movie that has super smart filmmaking, and I feel like it leads up to any of the blockbusters I've seen in the last 6 months. Like, it's that good, it's that quality. But it's a very different film, yes, I will say that. But it's a film, you know what I mean? And I think we've lost that. And I'm not railing against Marvel films. Like, you and I have talked about them. We love them. But they are an entity of themselves. They are like a microcosm of production. They know how to make their movies. Even though they sometimes get out of hand, right? But
at this point, those movies feel like what the in the 80s you had like the birth of this like teen romp kind of thing, with the John Hughes stuff, and then in the 90s those movies were like so ubiquitous, like there were it was like superhero movies today, where they were just westerns is probably a better analogy.
Yes,
where it's like
very much
there's
so
many, and like it's all that people are making past the, it's like, god, that's like enough with all of this. Eventually I think we will get to the point, unfortunately nobody really makes westerns now unless it's just like very, very low budget stuff, but every once in a while somebody will get the money and you'll get the talent on both sides of the camera attached and you'll get a really, really good western. That, you know, isn't made by God, what's the TV guy? What's it? Sheridan.
Oh, Taylor Sheridan?
Yeah.
It isn't made by Angel Studios.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a good Western. It doesn't have some stupid fucking alt message to it. It's just like, it's like, this is it. But, like, yeah, like, I don't know, like, I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. Even though like things seem to be crashing, like there's a lot of good stuff out there right now. Like genuinely good. Like, I saw 2 documentaries this week, and I want to hit you with them and see if you've ever heard about them. The first one being about one is a sports doc, and the other one is a music doc. And so, Questlove. I love Questlove. I mean, who doesn't? I don't think anybody doesn't. But he decided to.
I want to watch this. Is it good?
Yes. Oh man, it is so good.
I interrupted you before. Sorry.
No.
There you go, Sly.
Sly Lives, aka the Burden of Black Genius. Man, this is so good and so much more than just Sly and the Family Stone, which, like, I didn't. like I was like I've been a fan, but now I want to actually go back. I'm going to go back and actually listen to his Sly and the Family Stone's music, because it doesn't just like, what's the greatest part about this documentary is that it doesn't just give you the story of Sly and the tragic story of Sly and the Family Stone, but it also gives you a larger context in which he really does like it, like the AKA the Burden of Black Genius is really a very huge underpinning of this doc. And this doc, I will say, it is not like a little under 2 hours. It is not a chore. It is a vibrant, beautiful film filled with a lot of music, a lot of great talking heads, but also like just culminating with a bunch of great like footage of Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, I saw that he got like not just like great archival footage of them, but like there's archival footage of like Whitney and Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder, and like just the list is huge. The only thing I've seen from the doc, and it really, really got me interested in watching it, was them talking about Dance to the Music and like the recording of that and how it's like just a fuck you. So like, man, nobody wants to hear your message. They just want to hear music they can dance to. So he's like, okay, here you go. And it becomes like this huge song.
Yeah, it's like that's actually one of the centerpieces of the doc. And I know why they like it's such a ballsy like kind of thing that I know why they put it in front and center in the trailer and the advertisements. But there's so much more to this. Like you hear Andre 3000 talk about. Yeah. What to hear Questlove talk about what Sly meant to them and what it meant to music in a context that you're like, oh shit, maybe I should I think Andre just says him and Big Boy both say like without Sly there is no Outkast. Yeah, he's like they were doing.
Yeah, listen to Speaker Box and like then go listen to some Sly and the Family Stone, and it's just like, okay, yeah, like you're wearing that like on your sleeve, like that's our musical influence. It's definitely, it's on Hulu, right?
Yes, it is on Hulu and also Disney Plus, because it's not weird fucking enough that we have weird shit that we have to fucking actually deal with this bullshit of like, oh yeah, Hulu and Disney Plus, like yeah, please dilute my brand, please. But yeah, it's on Disney and Hulu Plus. Like I know because I don't have the bundle that matches them together because I'm smart and I know that money that costs more money. But you can see it because it's like it says content from Hulu, and that's actually where I watched it, which is interesting enough. And it's great. Like it truly is great. It's one of the first great things of the year. The other one is a documentary I was not expecting, like, and I'm a huge, like this, like everybody knows I'm a huge basketball fan. Like it's like, that's my, like, you know, that's one of my top three sports, if not my top sport. So have you heard of this documentary called We Beat the Dream Team?
No.
Okay. So this is great. And this is something that you're going to want. I know that you're going to want to watch. It's on HBO Max. It just debuted on Monday. And basically, here's the coverage for it. Discover the little-known story of a group of college basketball players who were tasked with preparing Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan and the rest of the legendary Dream Team for their Olympic debut. And it's about – so here are the college players that played for what they called the Select Team. Now, we all know what the Select Team is now if you're into NBA – or if you're into a Olympic basketball. They are the college scrub. They are the supposed college scrubs that face off against whatever team is the Olympic team to prep them. Well, this is the first iteration of them. They consisted of Grant Hill, Chris Webber, Penny Hardaway, Bobby Hurley, Jamal Mashburn, Allen Houston, Rodney Rogers, and Eric Montrose.
See, I don't watch basketball. So, I mean, I know some players. Like, I can name probably 15 basketball players. Well, maybe more than that. But you say that, though, that's the I know who every one of those people is.
Exactly, because they're all fucking Hall of Famers, right? So these are all, these guys are all, like, in the midst of their college careers, right?
That's crazy, man. And then we all go on to be NBA legends.
Exactly. So they get everybody together, right? And it's their first scrimmage. And it's how these kids beat the shit out of the Dream Team in their first scrimmage. And it's true. And it's the fallout that happened. And the reasons why we don't know about this, partially because of two people, and when you hear these names, you exactly fucking know why then this is the way that it played out. Coach K, and of course, the legend, the Pistons coaching legend, that is Chuck, good Lord, what is his name?
You got me. When it comes to coaches, I don't know any of them.
Good Lord. Chuck Daly. Chuck Daly from the Pistons. The two of the shittiest people, shittiest coaches in basketball history. Coach K and Chuck Daly, who were the coaches, the coach. Chuck Daly was the coach of the Dream Team. And Coach K was the assistant. And literally erased this fact from basically like college, like from history. And
can you imagine being like, who all did you say? Like Chris Webber.
Oh, like Grant Hill.
Grant Hill. Yeah. Can you imagine being Grant Hill in college and you're on a team that beats these guys that, and you're telling people, and everybody's just like, whatever, man. No, you didn't.
The best part is that they have photographic evidence. They have one VHS camera and it was kept. And so they actually have proof of the scoreboard of this game that ended up being 52-68 by the select team. But the greater story about it is the erasure of it. And Coach K's like they go, like, you know, Grant Hill was coached by Coach K because, you know, Duke, right? Like, and how, like, the best part is at the end how Grant Hill goes after him. And, you know, once Coach K has something in his head, like, you, I've seen it before time and time again, he does not kind of pull away from it. Like, he keeps the lie or whatever his version of the truth is. But to see him kind of finally admit, yeah, you know, you guys did beat them. But, you know, Daly took Jordan out of the game, which he didn't. You watch it and you go, you see it's clearly a fucking lie that Coach K is talking about. And, like, then he says, oh, well, you know, Daly just wanted to prove a point. And I was like, no, he didn't. He unexpectedly had a point, which is that these kids played together like a team and they were hungry. And the Dream Team came in and it's all build up. Like, you could see it, like. The best part is that you can see that these, like, led by Larry Legend, doing stupid Larry Legend things, which, like, you know, he tells all of these kids, he, like, is really nice to them, and then he tells them, he's like, get ready to get your asses handed to you. And it's Larry is, the drunk-ass Larry is the reason why these kids all solidify, because they're just like, fuck that, fuck you. They're too young to not know that they're going up against the Dream Team, even though they know it's the Dream Team, right? He insulted their egos. And so it's a whole thing of, like, it's a great doc because it builds up to the moment of the first scrimmage. And then the scrimmage happens, and like they do the perfect thing is that they use like the first part of the doc. I don't know how they got it, but they used Bill Conti's music from Rocky. And I will tell you, I haven't had like this doc pump me up in a way like that no action movie has pumped me up recently. Like it does its effective job where it's like it's telling me something that I didn't know about. And you know the outcome because they obviously beat them. But the way that it's built up is like the true, like a true sports documentary should, or any kind of sports like themed movie does, which is it builds you up to that moment of the actual game or the event that they're covering. And man, it's a great doc. It's like just like it's 83 minutes. Like, how can you go wrong with 83 minutes, right? And it has superstars in it. It has drama. It has like controversy. And but also at the end of the day, like these kids didn't get credit for what they did, which is prepare the Dream Team for their epic run. They made them realize, oh shit, a team.
We gotta step up. Like we can't. Exactly. You have. I mean, it was the Dream Team. Like you're talking about literally, arguably the greatest people that have ever played in the NBA, all on one team, all playing for the Olympics, and walking onto a court thinking, we're the greatest people that have ever played in the NBA. We don't have anything to worry about. But they'd also never played with each other for the most part.
Nope.
And like they you got to be able to work as a team. So getting beat, like, I understand the desire to squash that and, like, not have it, you know, publicized. But also, like, I haven't seen the doc, obviously, but getting beat would be the greatest thing for them before they get to the Olympics. Because nothing would, like, you're talking about, like, losing in the Olympics to literal unknown people. And these are the greatest people that have ever played basketball. That would have been devastating.
Absolutely. Which eventually happened. Like, that's the thing is that eventually in 2004, and people will make this whole fucking thing about, well, Kobe didn't play. And I'm like, yeah, but you had Tim Duncan, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Allen Iverson, Stephen Marbury, Dwayne Wade, and they couldn't.
Again, not an NBA guy, but I gotta believe that, like, if you take even, you know, if half the team is the greatest people in the NBA currently and put them against anybody else in the world, I and it's not even America thing. We're talking about people that play at such a great level. I would every time I'd be like, they're gonna beat those guys. They're gonna beat those guys. Like, they're the greatest playing the game currently. There's no way they're losing. And when it happens, yeah, it's got to be ego, man.
It is. It's the fact that they don't play like. And there's another documentary that I'm currently watching right now that was produced by Obama, which is about the 2024 Olympics, and like about the basketball teams in 2024 Olympics and how the 2004 Olympics really kind of solidified European basketball as we can do this, we can beat the gods, and how they approach things. It's an interesting documentary because it also talks about USA basketball and the current iteration and how hard it is to take these guys, these superstars, and gel them into a team, like an actual team, and how like the coaches, like the biggest thing that I took away from it is how big of a challenge that somebody like Steve Kerr, who's the coach of USA basketball, along with Grant Hill, who's the managing director of USA basketball, and all of these coaches have, and there's so many superstar assistant coaches. And the reason is because they have to take these guys and take them from their superstar ego, like leaders, to like, okay, you're going to sit on the bench for most of the time, but I need you to play like a team. And how do you do that? And that is the ultimate goal, because, and they say this time and time again, if you don't play like a team, if you don't solidify and actually do what you're supposed to do and not do your ego ball thing, we're going to lose. We're going to lose to one of these teams, because these teams are built to play with chemistry.
Yep.
They play all the time. That's all they do. They may not have their superstar. They may not have their Jokic or their Luka Doncic or whoever.
They know what that team knows what they're doing as a team. And you're all out there trying to show that you're the best, and they're playing as a team. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that makes sports like endlessly watchable is
exactly
stuff like that. Like seeing, you know, somebody like just come along and take down a great, or watching, you know, I it will forever be one of the worst moments in my life, but were I a Patriots fan, like watching Tom Brady rally that team in the Super Bowl and come back from like an impossible deficit.
Yep.
And win. Like, come on, man. it's incredible. It sucks because it happened to my team, but it's still incredible. Like, yeah, it's. That's pretty interesting. You would have, I don't know if I were those guys on that team, man, I would be fucking like, I would have been beating that drum forever. But they, like you said, they all went on to become NBA legends. So,
well, like afterwards, like this was a rumor that went all around. Like this was like. Like, it's not like, so the reason why the doc exists is because everybody, it was one of the worst kept secrets and nobody believed it because there was no footage. There was no pictures. There was no nothing. Like, I even heard about it. Like, I had heard about it, like around the time that in 2004, when when that version of the Dream Team lost the goal, they lost everything. They didn't even. And then, like, you know, like the loss that they took, we had heard like, oh, well, this wasn't the first time. What are you talking about? Well, there was a scrimmage between the select team and the first Dream Team where they lost by like eight. Well, like first it was 25 points, then it was 2 points, and then it came like to where it was like 10 points or something like that, which is actually closer to the truth, which was like, you know, they lost by 12. That's what the scoreboard says, right? It was like 58 to 70 or something like that, or 54 to 68, something like that, right? But we had heard it, but we never, like, and then all the guys, because they were kind of like, because the footage wasn't around and they didn't want to have, like, even Weber says it. He's like, well, you know, like, we'd tell people, but nobody would fucking believe us. And it's like, why would anybody believe them? And that's the shittiest part about this, is that now they have proof. Now the legend isn't the legend. And I mean, like, so like, you know, the Dream Team, the first guy, the only college guy was Christian Laettner. And Laettner has always been on, like, Laettner was like, yeah, they beat us. They kind of beat us. I mean, they were a team. He's like, I was the token college kid because I was going to be drafted first. And Coach K wanted me there. And then he was just like, yeah, just kind of like, I see my friend Grant and like they were locked in, man. He's like, and he's always been on their side. He's like, yeah, they beat us, but nobody believed him because he was just like, it was Christian Laettner, right? Like, so it's kind of wild to see this legend that's churned into this like deep state lie, right? Like, oh, they're just lying, da 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 da. But then there's other real people like, oh yeah, they really did beat them. To actually come true and actually have the footage, like it wasn't destroyed, like whatever, whoever is the PA that fucking when either Daly or like fucking Coach K came up to him and said burn it, and they just kept it because they knew that it was going to be some kind of piece of like history, whoever that person is, thank you. Thank you. Because we wouldn't have this, and these kids, these guys who turned into Hall of Famers all themselves, wouldn't have this story to be confirmed. It's like I said, like it's probably one of the better things I've seen in a while, just because of how effective it is with its, with the way it tells a sports story with the buildup, and then the game, and then the fallout of it. And it's on HBO Max. It's 83 minutes, guys. Like, if you're a sports fan, even if you're not a sports fan, if you just like good, like, intense movies, like, this is something for you.
Yeah, I'll have to try to check it out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I didn't text you and ask you if you caught up with it, but I can ask you now. If so, we'll talk about it for a second. Did you watch the Spider-Man finale?
No, I did not. I am 6 episodes behind because of all of the three drops, but it sounds like you did. And did they land the ending?
Oh, fuck yeah, man. Like, I cannot say anything because the things I think are worth talking about are definitely spoilers. But
okay.
Yeah, I think this should have been a week-to-week show, man. I think they did it a huge fucking disservice dropping basically the entire show in 4 weeks.
Well, we can thank that little piece of shit. It's not well. Thank God for that. I'm fairly certain that when he said that, they were like, "Oh shit, we got to dump this show." Like, honestly, like that really feels, because it wasn't there. Like, they deleted it, but there is a Disney Plus. There was a Disney Plus schedule that showed 3-episode drop and then week to week for the next 7 weeks or 6 weeks. And it disappeared from their Disney social media because they just decided to dump it in, what, 2 weeks? Like, literally, we got this, all of this in, like, 2 or 3 weeks. Oh, God. I'm excited. It's just, it was so much. I mean, they dropped 6 episodes in 2 weeks. How the fuck am I supposed to catch up
with this? It was really, I honestly wouldn't have been able to catch up except it was so cold and icy that they let us work from home the last 2 days this week. And so it was a lot of me sitting here by myself. And when you're not busy and all your work is caught up and you're sitting here by yourself, as I'm sure, you know, you may or may not can attest to, you're like, oh, well, time to watch TV because there's nobody to bother you.
Exactly. Nobody come over and say, hey, how you doing?
Yep. Or, hey, can you help me with this? Yeah. Or, you know, I basically watched the last 5 or 6 episodes, like, in one night. And, I was like, the finale is so fucking good. Like, I cannot wait for season 2. I don't know how far along they are, but I'm excited for more X-Men 97.
Yes.
I hope that they are further along in Spider-Man than they were in X-Men 97, because I thought we were going to get more X-Men 97 this year, and I don't know if that's happening now.
I could have sworn, like, that was the weirdest part, is that I could have sworn that I had heard that they finished season 2, like, because DeMeo is still on. DeMeo is still on as EP and writer of most of those season 2 episodes, unless they're deciding to do the whole thing of like, okay, let's erase him because, well, we can spend $50 million on 10 new episodes and just completely veer off from whatever they were, whatever the season 2 was.
I hope not. Like, we still don't know what happened with Bo DeMeo, and I don't want to really speculate on it, but creatively, whatever his input was for season 1 is so good. Like, I just roll with what you got, man. It, like, is it bad? Like, I mean, if it's something so terrible that the dude doesn't deserve a paycheck, then I feel like we should know what it is.
Absolutely. Like, if you're gonna do it, do it. Like if you're gonna say that this guy was a POS, then tell us the exact reasons why. Or is it that you're so, like, like, we already know what's going to happen is that if they even release one thing, he's going to sue the shit out of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I guess in this whole, like, I'm not going to talk about the other person that everybody seems to be assassinating right now, which, you know, God, what fucking world are we in when
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I know. So, but we won't talk about that. But needless to say, like, you know, whatever it is, fucking Jesus Christ, just give us season two. I don't give a shit about this anymore. Just give us season two. Come on.
So I don't want to get political, but people should pay for their crimes. But, like,
yes,
the very cynical, like, thing that lives inside of me is, like, has been thinking, like, well, if anything good comes out of this, maybe at least we won't have this constant stop and start and, like, oh, we can't work with this person because they said this. We can't work with that person because they did this. Some people, like, I'm not talking about, like, the Weinsteins of the world. Fuck those people. Just the what happened with James Gunn, which I know has been a huge backtrack and, like, seems to have been forgotten about. But there was, like, a year there where it was like, well, we can't touch him with a 10-foot pole. And shit like that where, like, companies were so worried about the optics of something somebody tweeted that, you know, they would just be like, oh, well, we can't work with them. I think the death of that isn't a terrible thing. You know? The people that do truly, truly awful, actual things. It is kind of funny seeing, like, Kevin Spacey this week start to, like, lash out at people. Those people can fuck off and, like, I'll be happy if they never work again. But,
yeah,
things like somebody said something, you know, really offhanded that they probably shouldn't have said, then, you know, seeing them kind of make their way back is, you know, not the worst thing. But anyway, we're talking about fucked up shit. Let's talk about some fucked up shit that happens in a movie.
Oh, God, yes, please.
All right, let's talk about the Monkey Man. Not Monkey Man, the Monkey.
Man. The Monkey. Come on, man.
You saw this, what, a couple of weeks ago?
Yes.
So was it? But I'm curious. I'm assuming you can talk about it. Was it a screener? Okay. Was it like a special screening?
It was a press screening. It was one of the first press screenings. In my tier of people that reviewers that get to go see things. So I got to see it in a nice theater. With a group of press people. I will tell you, it was one of my favorite experiences because of how uncomfortable it. So, like, the people it vibed with, you could tell because we were laughing. I say we because I was one of those people. We were laughing through the whole thing. You could tell the people that it didn't vibe with because, oh man, did they feel uncomfortable? You could feel the tension in them from the get go. It was kind of great because it was the best kind of screening because the people that were laughing, that were vibing with it, it's the kind of movie that feels like it feeds off of the tension of others, that the discomfort of others in the movie, that find the movie uncomfortable because of whatever. Like, it feeds off of that with you who finds this movie to be, like, this great fucking piece of mania. Because, like, I kept on getting the giggles through the whole fucking thing. Like, but then once it got serious at the end, once it got to, like, the point where it was like, fuck you, we're taking no prisoners. Like, it definitely felt it, and you kind of like stopped the giggles, and it was like, oh shit, this is, yeah, this is happening. This is kind of great. But it still never managed to not be at least smile worthy in my estimation, like through the whole entire thing, no matter how dark it got. It was this whole thing of like, damn, Osgood Perkins, you're a fucking maniac. You made exactly what Stephen King likes to do with his short stories, which makes it a bear trap, an attractive bear trap that you cannot get out of. And I still remember the story, and the story is very different. Like the movie and the short take like some very different turns. But I
think it's interesting the changes that are made. One of which is the monkey, which yes. I'm sure you know, but like the monkey from the story is just this cymbal banging monkey, which we've all seen. And especially if you've seen Toy Story, it's specifically the monkey, like as kind of described in that story, because it's Toy Story 3. I forget who directed the third one. I don't remember his name. Anyway, Toy Story 3 has... Yeah, that's right. He put that monkey in Toy Story 3 because he's a fan of Stephen King and that story. Yes. And he thought it would be a fun little thing. And Disney now has a copyright for a cymbal banging monkey, apparently. So they couldn't use a cymbal banging monkey for this movie. So they came up with the drum. If this story is true, if everything I said is true, that is one of those things that is the happiest of accidents.
Yes.
Because I don't know that the cymbal banging monkey has the tension that the way they use the drum banging, like the up and down motion of his arms, and like is played to such effect.
The twisting
and creates so much fucking tension. The drumstick going around, like it's so fucking perfect. This is damn near a perfect film. Like it's so fucking close to perfect.
Yep, it's wild because it does something that I think that like so. Perkins has talked about how this, like, he's a really, like, I mean, of course, like once you see this movie, you understand that he is a very big fan of Stephen King. But he was like, part of his love, it like, he was like, I wanted to make this movie, like, the ending, he's like, it doesn't work. He's like, that ending doesn't work. But what I did want to do was do something that was more akin to The Mist, but The Mist story, short, rather than The Mist movie. And right. When you hear that, you're like, holy shit, he did do that, which makes it even more of a Stephen King kind of like adaptation, like the perfect kind of Stephen King adaptation, because he's basically talking, he's in conversation with King's short story work. Like this isn't just like, oh yeah, it's the monkey. It's like there's so much going on in this film that's speaking towards the work of Stephen King, but not like the novels, but the short stories and how they interact with things. There's bullies, there's brotherhood, there's relationships between fathers and sons, which is a huge part, which is something that nobody ever tackles.
You're 100% right. So King does this thing, like Spielberg, it gets talked about a lot, like absentee fathers, and like it's very prevalent in his work. It doesn't get talked about a lot with Stephen King's work, at least not in places I see, this like weird relationships with fathers and also semi-sexual relationships with mothers that is pretty prevalent in Kingsport, or just out and out sexual relationships with mothers. It's pretty prevalent in King's work. And I don't know if it's intentional, but there's definitely something with Tatiana Maslany and the kids that it's not overtly sexual, but she's definitely got this weird relationship with her sons.
Yes.
It's not exactly motherly.
No, it is definitely not. Like, my favorite thing is that he, like, and I wanted to ask you, like, I loved the fact that he decided to make Hal and Bill twins, but how I found twins to be very opposite of each other, like very distinct personalities.
It rang really, really true for me.
Okay.
So, one of the weird themes of this movie, there's so much shit we could talk about with this movie. Not only is it scary, not only is it funny, but it also deals with some heavy, heavy shit in a way that you don't realize that it's dealing with heavy shit, like the brotherhood of it all. And that kind of competitive thing. And the, like, I love you, but I hate you thing, it rings really, really true. And at times that made it really difficult for me because, you know, not to dive into too much shit, but I had a twin brother. He passed away. At times our relationship, a lot of times our relationship was very contentious. And so watching that, honest to God, this, if my brother and I found a monkey that did this, this is probably a good approximation of how all of this would have played out. Like, it's ridiculous, but, like, that's probably what, like, you know, down to, like, hey, man, like, I love you and I'm sorry. And it still ends with one of us dying, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Which I mean, not to be darkly funny, but it did end with one of us dying. He passed away. So.
Yeah. it's weird because it's weird because, like, I've known a couple of, like, twin brothers in my life, like, more than a few, like, at least six. I know that sounds weird, but it, like, I feel like from the outside looking in, it gets that weird dynamic. Like it's already weird enough when your brothers or your brothers and sisters, there's a very weird dynamic, but it makes it stickier when you're a twin. And the way that it plays out, the way that it plays with trauma, the way that it plays with the love, and also what I feel like, okay, so like in any like sibling relationship, what I feel like movies do never get is the, like, they either get the love or the hatred. They never get that dynamic right because, like, it's both. You can hate your, like, what I love most about this film is that it does exactly what King does without ever having, like, okay, so, like, the inciting incident that starts this entire film that severs everything is something that is so King-like, but is not in the short story, right? And that just, like, it's so brilliant that Perkins writes this story, but also adds, like, you know that he's a twin as well, right?
No,
like
that, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes.
That makes sense.
It does, right? Like, when you hear that. But also, like, he gets that moment of, like, siblingness of, like, there's always moments where you literally feel like you want to kill your sibling. that you want to, like, you know, go back to the womb and strangle them in with their umbilical cord, which I think is actually something that he says, that one of them says.
I'm gonna eat the rest of it, because this is a whole thing about the placenta in the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, why he's, like, the stronger, bigger brother, and he got more of the placenta, and he threatens him by going, like, I'm gonna eat the rest of the placenta, the rest of your placenta, if you don't do what I say. And it's like, it's such a fucked up way to threaten somebody.
But also, again, so much of a king kind of piece of dialogue. But it's like, he takes that moment that King always does, which is he finds a very human, barren moment of, like, I want to kill my brother. And he
I mean, dude, the stuff in the school, the bullying, like,
yeah.
I mean, I am not even joking when it's like, yeah, my brother and his friends, like, used to think it was fun to just pick on me because I was a quiet kid, didn't have a shit ton of friends. Like, yeah, that happened. Like, it's not. So a lot, and it's weird watching it and being like, yeah, yeah. Like, I understand what you're saying here.
Yeah.
But, and not feeling like, oh, this is uncomfortable because it's making me think about my childhood. Like, it's just done in such a way that, I don't know. I cannot believe how fucking well made this movie is. I really, really can't. I didn't see Long Legs. I know that was the last Perkins film that, like, mm-hmm. everybody was blowing up about. Came out, what, last year?
Yeah, last year. In the summer.
This dude must be, like, just working.
You know he has another one coming out in the fall with Tatiana as the lead.
Really?
Yeah. It's something that I did not cover for our, but I knew about it doing my research.
She does not get it. Like, I understand why her screen time's limited. Like, that it's not her story, but she doesn't get enough. But I I'm a Tatiana fucking, like, diehard.
Yeah.
It's
called The Keeper.
Okay.
And it comes out in October, and it's basically her movie. I feel like Perkins realized, like, I don't think that people really truly realize how great she is. And I think that casting her in this made him go, oh yeah, you know what? Let's go ahead and work together. And he made a two-hander. Like, it's literally a movie where she's stuck in a cabin. Like,
okay.
That's the concept, is that her and her husband have a romantic anniversary at a remote cabin, and then he has to leave and she's left alone, and something sinister in the cabin is there. Like, that's all it's about. Okay. So, yeah, like, that's coming out in October. We have another one that to look forward to, because
Jeez, this dude's working like crazy, man.
Yep. Well, I think also who released it is, like, in the Osgood Perkins business now. Like, well, because
I you saw Long Legs, I didn't. I haven't seen anything else he's directed. He's also an actor. He does pop up in this movie. He gets one really, really great, like, line reading / scene on the stairwell that's so fucking good. As a bit part actor, I've seen him in a couple of things here and there, and he's very recognizable, but also, like, in that character actor, kind of like, I know you from something, but, like, I can't put my finger on it. And I guess maybe that created, like, a lot of goodwill with it. Because, like, there's some people that pop up in this movie for literally seconds. It opens with maybe one of the best movie cameos that we'll see this year.
Don't call it a fucking toy. Oh, man. He's so good. And the hat sells it all. Like, I didn't I was like, why the fuck's he got that hat on? And then when it comes back, I just, wow. But go ahead, continue on.
So I went and saw this with my friend Stephanie, and I should say lady friend, whatever label you want to put on it. Anyway, who I went and saw Captain America with, and she loved it as well. Like we saw it in a theater. There were maybe 10 people in the theater, which is a damn shame, because I feel like the more people you see this with, the better it's going to play.
I can attest to that. Seeing it in a packed house, it, like I said, like the tension of people not getting it actually makes it kind of
funnier. Yeah. So Adam Scott opens the movie, and at the end of the movie, I had to out, and I'll out myself here.
Mm-hmm.
I kept waiting for the Adam Scott thing to tie back in, because it was not until over halfway through the movie that I realized that Adam Scott was playing their dad.
Yes. Yes.
And like, I think it's in the conversation he's having with his son, Petey, where he's talking about his dad and like not really knowing him and him, something to do with family. And it clicked in my head and I was like, oh, like that's what the shit in the beginning was.
Yep.
Like that's why they think he left and just never came back, because he's dead.
He's dead because he tried to burn. Like, my favorite part is this motherfucker. How did he get a flamethrower? It's first off, but also,
I mean, it's like, just in the pawn shop.
Exactly. Like, it's like, what? Like, and then he just burns the motherfucker. And it's like,
how did the monkey get back in the box and then in the closet?
Exactly. Like, that's my favorite fucking part, is that it's never explained how that fucking monkey gets back into that Tiffany box and says, turn the crank and see what
happens.
Definition of fuck around and find out.
I love, so one of the things that Perkins does, and King doesn't do it in his short story either, but the idea of the short story is not to dive into the mythology. And this day and age, it becomes all about the mythology of things. And I love that Perkins just goes with the story of like, yeah, you turn this monkey on, fucked up shit happens. We're not getting into why. And nobody in the movie is going to get into why. They just, like, say, okay, this is, like, you turn the key, he bangs the drum, fucking people die. We know that that's true because we've seen it happen. We don't care why it's true. And they just, it adds to that believability. Because when you try to start explaining something as batshit insane as that, you lose yourself in the plot, you know? And the fact that they don't, like, just lends more to the ludicrousness of the story and makes it even funnier. But, like, not only is Adam Scott in the movie for a minute and a half, Elijah Wood is in the movie for a minute and a half. And I don't know what, like, I understand what's going on there, but it's so crazy.
It's like, such a stupid, funny moment. I was like, what? Like, or Sarah Levy as their aunt. Like,
yeah. I didn't even recognize her.
I was like, well, like, I was watching, it's like, is that fucking, what's her name from Schitt's Creek? I was like, no, it can't be. I'm like, that's just too much makeup. And I noticed
she looks 20 years older.
Yep. It's just great makeup effect, right? Like, I just was like, holy shit. Like, but like, going back to Wood as this, the new husband, like, oh my God. Oh my God, dude. Like, I was just like, holy shit, are you kidding me? It was just hilarious. But also, like, so there's a moment where, like, we, like, Hal and Bill have a babysitter. Did you notice what her name was?
No.
Annie Wilkes.
Okay.
I literally, I was like, what? And the only reason why I know is when she dies, when she has her fucking funeral.
The priest. The fucking priest. Oh, my God.
The fucking priest was the best. Oh, my God. Like I was giggling so hard, and you could see like people shaking up their heads. The
mic, he's like, looks at all these people, he's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Like, he just finished a dube. Like, and he didn't realize that this was what the fuck was gonna happen. Oh, fuck. Oh, shit. And then he just both him and both her funeral and their mother's funeral. I mean, like, spoiler alert, guys. I mean, we're gonna ruin this shit. Like, you know, like, that's, like, you know, like, that's one of the things. Like, I feel like you can kind of tell from the trailers that that's what happens. Because of the moments with Ms. Lonnie and her, like, the blood and stuff. So, like,
yeah.
But, I mean, we tell you that we're ruining everything. I'm not ruining anything right now. But, like, both of their funerals.
The tagline of the movie is everybody dies and that's fucked up.
Yep.
Yeah, all of the bit players in this are just fucking pitch down to the lieutenant that's like interviewing him when the real estate lady, like,
oh yeah,
it's all like just these little bit players that I don't recognize most of them, but they're all so fucking perfect. Everything is just pitch perfect. Like the real estate lady is so annoying.
You
want her to die, but when she dies, it's so like shocking. And like, I don't know, man. Like every death was just
Ricky.
Insane.
Ricky.
Yeah.
Ricky, the guy, the like Bill's fucking right hand incompetent man, he's not really his right hand man. He's the guy who he steals the monkey from, Ricky, and like all of the shit that Ricky goes through. But then his death is so fucking shocking. It's so fucking wild, and it's towards the end, right?
Yeah, it's the one. I think it plays, but it's the one effect in the movie that I don't think looks that great.
The
aftermath looks good.
The aftermath
flying into him. It's clearly a straight digital effect because it has to be. And it everything else is so like mix of practical with some digital stuff that that's the one thing that like looks a little off. But I do think that like it is this wild, like you keep waiting, like you know he's going to die.
Yeah.
And everything that keeps happening is like, oh, this is how he's gonna die. This is how he's gonna die. And then it's like, no, we're gonna do it in the most bizarre way possible. Because you keep waiting for him to be like, oh shit, I'm allergic to bees or wasps or whatever. And it's not that. You know?
No, it's still not that. And then it's so funny how it just subtly starts to like raise the stakes, and you don't realize until Bill and Hal have their moment together, right? And then what happens to Bill happens, that we're watching like we're watching the apocalypse begin, right? Like that's the thing that I appreciated more than anything else, was that it hides things such in plain sight that you're like, oh, dude, fuck, when it happens, you're like, holy shit.
This is a movie where Colin O'Brien, who we haven't really talked about as young Petey, who is absolutely fantastic. And this is actually his second Stephen King adaptation. He's in Mr. Harrigan's Phone on Netflix. I need to go back and watch that. I just read that story, and it's so good. I need to go back and watch the Netflix. But he gets, like, at some point has some pamphlets about this town that they're going to, and he's reading something and offhandedly says, well, they have skydiving and you can even get married as a joke. And that plays out at the end of the movie when the whole fucking town dies and a plane crashes through the building and the marrying skydivers fall through the roof of that bunker. That's insane. That is the most insane payoff for something that if you're not paying attention, you don't even know what it is when the lady in the wedding dress falls through. It's just like, what the fuck is happening? But it's paying off something that this kid said 45 minutes ago.
Or the cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Cheerleaders. like the moment of the chip, you're like, why the fuck? That is such an odd thing to have. Like it's such a, like, it's a movie of like all of these non sequiturs that you think are non sequiturs but are not non sequiturs. If that makes any sense whatsoever. It's like you're watching these cheerleaders, you're like, that's a fucking weird odd thing. Like, but then I guess this is just Oz Perkins being Oz Perkins. But it's not, because it pays off completely at the end. And my favorite thing is that this is a movie that literally takes the man on a pale horse.
Yeah, and you see it. They say it a few times in the movie, and then you literally see the man on the pale horse, like death, like riding through town.
And literally, you're like, Jesus fucking Christ, that is the creepiest fucking image I've seen ever. And you see, like, and he looks, like the best part is that he looks at Al, his son, and he's just like, no, not you, not yet. Like, it's like this weird kind of, like, it's this weird, super serious, but cheeky humor. Like, I cannot, like, he is such a fucking, like, it's such a weird, it's a weird movie, but it's not. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you describe it to somebody, like, people would be like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is a weird movie, right? And you're like, no, it's not. It's deadpan, but it never feels like it doesn't earn every single piece of the deadpanness, right?
Oh, absolutely. The post like funeral thing with Tatiana and the two, which I say two boys, but so let's talk about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Young Hal, young Bill, older Hal, older Bill, two actors. Christian Convery plays young Hal and young Bill. So you have this kid playing two different people, you know, twins. And at no point do I not believe that it's two separate actors. Because very singular performances. Like, there's no, like, oh, he's just doubling himself. They are two different people. And honestly, you can tell that they're twins, but they don't look that much alike. And that it's the same actor. Like, they only, like, look like each other, but it's weird. It's when you know twins, they're twins where it's like, yes, I can tell that you're twins, but also I'm never going to be confused by which of you is which. And it's not just because one of them's wearing glasses. Like, it's a completely different person. And the fact that I don't know how old Christian Convery was when they filmed this, but not a lot of young actors can deliver that kind of thing.
No. Because I initially thought he was a fucking, like, they were twins.
He thought it was a twin. Like, think it's two people. Like, oh, they got twins to play this part. And no, it's one kid. And, like, He's fucking fantastic, man.
He is super fantastic. Like, yeah, and, no, absolutely.
And then you have Theo James as Hal slash Bill. I've seen Theo James in quite a bit. Most people probably know him from the Divergent, like all of that stuff.
Yeah. Which
of course I've seen him in, and also like that was probably the thing that I dismissed him for, because I was like, yeah, well, that's exactly. Not my shit. I don't care about any of that. Like, it's whatever. But like, he's also in two of the later Underworld movies that I didn't see, and now I kind of want to go back and revisit, because I do think that I have completely unfairly judged this dude based on like, oh, he looks good and he was in those, like, you know,
YA movies.
Yes.
Yeah. So, also, he's in The Gentlemen, like, which makes me want
to. I need to go back and watch that. I need to go watch.
Yeah. Why did we, like, we both liked Guy Ritchie, and why did we sleep on a Guy Ritchie TV show?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm like, that motherfucker, like, directed, like, half the episodes. I'm like, why did I not go back? Why did I not watch the, like, oh, Jesus. And, like, and he's British. And he does, like, American so well. Like, that Theo James. Like that's another thing that, like, to add into it is that,
he's
like,
so fucking good in this. Like,
he really is.
He plays the, like, the humor and the pathology of it all, like, so perfectly. That's what I'm saying. Like, I have obviously completely misjudged this dude as an actor. But also, like, much like his young counterpart, it's the same guy, but he is still giving you two very different performances that,
yeah,
it's really impressive. The disheveled, like, brother, like, wearing the old, obviously, the, like, altered too small suit, like, with the like, kid tie that can't go around his neck all the way. Like,
my God.
It's that's such a small thing that, like, that's the movie never calls attention to the things like that.
It doesn't play it like a joke. Like, it could be a joke, and in any other movie it's a joke, but in Perkins' world, it literally is just his armor. Like, what makes it funny is that Bill literally thinks that this is the way that he protects himself.
Yep.
Like, and then what he does to extend it with the flaming fucking, oh my God.
Yeah.
But that's the way that a kid who is, like, a guy who is still at heart, that 13-year-old boy who lost his mom, who is stunted from that piece of trauma, would do. It's just like the haircut. Like, the haircut sells because James doesn't play it like a joke.
Yeah.
It's like...
Perkins never... There's not a single line of dialogue. Like, when the brothers finally see each other again... Like, he looks at him, and the way he looks at him, it is very, like, empathetic or, like, sympathetic and, like, God, what have you done to yourself? But at no point does he say, Jesus, you're still wearing that suit. You still have the same. He never calls attention to it.
Never.
It's just they, and, like, it's such smart filmmaking. In an era of, like, we were talking about the Marvel stuff, they feel like they have to tell you everything that you're seeing just in case you're not paying enough attention to it. And Perkins, it just doesn't do that. And this is the kind of movie that will, like, continually reward you every time you watch it, because there's things there that he's just not calling attention to.
No, never. And, like, I continually go back to, like, talking about old school filmmaking, but this feels like very purposely, this feels like a movie that could have been made in 1991, like right after Misery.
Yeah.
With the exception of a few CGI shots, this literally feels like a movie that if we had gotten it and it showed the Castle Rock, like if we had watched, okay, let me go a little bit further up. Like if we had watched Needful Things, and then on the Needful Things, like in the theater, and then we saw a trailer, and the trailer said the Castle Rock logo, and then the trailer for The Monkey played, and it was like, you know, Let the Good Times Roll, the song, which like we haven't even talked about the needle drops that are perfectly Stephen King needle drops, right? I would believe it. And then if I saw this movie in 1995, right after I saw Needful Things, I would completely fucking believe it, because this movie is so kind of a certain kind of smart filmmaking from a certain era that we do not get anymore. Like Long Legs, when I compared it to Silence of the Lambs in its style and tone, that's the reason why I compared it to it, was because that's the kind of filmmaking it is. It's not like the same story, even though it's dealing with a serial killer and the FBI. It's very different. But the storytelling style is the exact kind of thing that we would get in the mid-90s, like from the smartest of filmmakers, from like people like Frank Darabont, from like, you know, from Rob Reiner. Like, though I would never see Rob Reiner doing this movie. Like, this movie is just too fucking wild for him to do it. But you know what I mean? Like when they do the, like, my favorite part of this movie is nothing to do with any of the cast. It's the sequences where there's the dream sequences of the monkey and how it goes into the weird kaleidoscope shit. Oh my God.
When he talks about seeing the monkey everywhere and he's like at that strip club.
And it's an actual fucking mask. Like, it's that tactileness. Like for me, like, that's what it is Oz Perkins makes tactile movies. Like, his other movies before, like, and I would definitely recommend The Black Coat's Daughter, Hansel and Gretel. Like, his Hansel and Gretel is, I don't know how he got away with a PG-13. That movie is truly frighteningly disturbing. Long Legs and the monkey, like, prep yourself for this, because it's like the movies all exist within the same kind of stylistic universe. So like, it would, like, if you don't want to be shocked by something, watch these movies and you'll get an understanding of the kind of thing that you're in store for. But it's also funny to me because these movies make complete sense from a kid who played young Norman Bates in Psycho 2.
I was about to say this guy, his first credit in a film is playing young Norman Bates in Psycho.
Yeah, like, this is a guy who put himself in his own movie, like, as the weirdest of weird characters. And also, like, so I need to find have you seen the poster with him on it?
No.
Like, okay, so like, there's a poster of him on it, and it's a quote. It says, it's a movie about about twin brothers who discover a toy monkey that likes killing their family. There's outrageous violence, shocking gore, and unspeakable tragedies. For Osgood Perkins, it's pretty fucking funny. There's this poster, and I want this fucking poster because it's like, I feel like we have seen the announcement of a filmmaker that is a character. If that makes sense. Like, we don't often get guys who are directors that are characters, or people that are,
it's
like,
few like, and far between.
Hitchcock, Spielberg, Cameron, these guys, like oftentimes these guys are Guillermo del Toro. These are guys that we know that become like kind of not characters, but like, I just sent you the poster via text. Oh,
that's great.
Yeah, and the look he has on his face, like, it's so fucking, like, it is so, like, this is the announcement. I feel like the monkey is, like, all the other movies were lead up to the monkey, and the monkey is this whole thing. And I think Neon, like, you know, slow clap for them, understand that this guy is going to be around for a long time. I mean, last year, Longlegs made $150 million for them. Let me repeat that. Longlegs, a movie that cost like $5 million, made $150 million for them. So, yeah, of course, they're going to be in the Osgood Perkins business. But them taking him and going, oh, you know what? He's kind of a caricature. Like, and let's make him that kind of, like, let's rise him up. Like, that's kind of a brilliant stroke. I mean, it makes me want to see his, like I said, like, I'm going to see The Keeper instantly because of this movie.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, it is so damn close to a perfect movie. It's not going to be forever. There's definitely people out there are going to be like you said, you know, it's the people not getting it make it somehow even better. But it's perfectly made. Everything's perfectly timed. It's not precious about anything that it's doing. Like, nobody feels safe. You know, and it just keeps catching you off guard. Like, even when you know something is coming, like, it tries to do something you don't expect. And at every single
day. Remember? Yeah. Like, that's the perfect example. Like, it's like,
you know she's going to die, but, like, how is she going to die? Like, you see it coming, but then... It feels like he takes some cues from like Final Destination, but does it better and somehow less ridiculous than the shit in Final Destination would get. So,
but where like Final Destination, you're laughing at it.
Yeah, this Funky is like laughing with it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, you know, you're like, oh shit. Like, okay. And it's just, man, it is like one of the like, you know, any of the deaths, like the way that the aunt dies, Jesus Christ, like that's so shocking, but at the same time it's kind of
you know she's about to die, like just the way the movie set everything up, like, oh, she's gonna die. It's like, oh, she's going to fall down the stairs and break her neck. No. Oh, the stairs are going to collapse and she's going to break her neck. No. Oh, she's going to, I don't know, accidentally rip her face off. And, oh, she's going to, instead, it's, oh, she puts rubbing alcohol on the wounds on her face and then leans down into a leaking fucking stove and it ignites and sets her. I was like, oh, she's gonna burn to death. That's how she's gonna die. No. She's gonna run down the stairs and fall and break her neck. There. That's how. Nope. She gets her leg stuck in some kind of tube and then runs face first into a fucking post on her mailbox and impales herself. Like, through the skull. And that's how she died. It is comical and also horrific at the same time. It's just fucking wild, man.
Yep. Very. Like, but also, like it never calls attention to this. It never makes it, like, there's this distance that makes it super fucking funny. Like, it's like, some people play chess. Some people play 3D chess. Like, Osgood Perkins plays 4D chess. Like, there's this weird spatialness that he is able to understand that makes it the closest I can tell people about this. Like, the way the tone and the kind of tenor is, I feel like if David Lynch watched this movie, if he was alive to watch this movie, he would just sit there and cackle the entire time. Yeah. And those two aliens, like, Osgood Perkins is not a human. Like, he's an alien. And he's the same kind of alien that David Lynch is. And they would sit there when they would communicate in their alien language and just sit there and go at each other. Because there's that, like I said, there's this 4D spatial reasoning that makes it just slightly less human and otherworldly, that makes it almost like an alien is telling us a story. Like, it's like an alien read Stephen King story and went, huh, I can do this better. And just decided to make this movie and go, huh, I'm going to make it about humans. And just made this very odd, very particular thing. And it just, it works. It's through and through.
And like I was saying earlier, like the horror works, the comedy works, but it's also doing this underlying, like, how we deal with death and grief and, like, how kind of stupid it all is, like, in the grand scheme of things. And, like, like Tatiana's speech about, like, you know, everybody dies. Like, you're gonna die. I'm like, it's fucked up to say that to your, like, 10-year-old kids who are already dealing with so much, but it's also not wrong. It's like,
no,
it's this, it's almost Shakespearean of like this, like life is a comedy and we're acting like it's a drama, but it, you know, it's just all in how you look at things. It's grief is, you know, ridiculous and funny, but also terrible. And it has something to say about like generational trauma. I mean, the fucking monkey is generational trauma, and the shit you dump on your loved ones, your children especially, and how they're going to carry that with them for the rest of their lives. And also probably even whether they want to, this man like disavowed himself of his own child because of his generational trauma, and yes, still manages to pass down the generational trauma to his fucking child. Like, it is so smart in like dealing with that without really dealing with it. Like it's on the same level of something like BoJack Horseman, which is a show I know I talk about way too much, but BoJack deals with that like kind of cheekily, or a lot of times cheekily, and but then we'll do like really, really heavy focus stuff. This movie doesn't have the time to do that, but it's like the opposite side of that, where it's just like touching the surface and being like, we're going to talk about this, but you're not going to realize that we're talking about this. And I don't know. It's fucking brilliant. And it's the kind of thing where it's like the Academy won't ever recognize anything like this. But I also, like, even on IMDb, like, it's like a 6.5 or something is the current rating. I don't know what it is sitting at on Rotten Tomatoes, but I guess if you don't get it, you don't get it. I know it's only February, and there's a lot of good shit coming. I will honestly be shocked if I see a better made film than this the rest of the year.
I could see it. Like, I could see that. Like it not being, like, it, there not being a different, like you not seeing anything better. Because it's, like, the execution of it and what its intent is literally, like, it does everything perfect. Like, there's no veering off. Like, there may be, like, I mean, like, there's no perfect movie, but, like, you know, as close as you get as an adaptation, I mean, it's actually outdoes its origins, because it takes a story that was, like, it does the best thing that a film can do, which is take a source material and make it better. Like, people are going to be disappointed when they read the short, because it doesn't have the twins. It doesn't have the opening moments. Like, it doesn't have it in the same way.
Yeah.
Because I reread it, because it's online. I reread it and I was like, oh man, now I know. Now I remember why I didn't remember it. I only remembered the symbol monkey in it, because it's such a light piece.
Yeah, I looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes because I was curious. Yeah, 66% on Rotten Tomatoes audience. And just for comparison, just since we talked about it last week, Captain America's audience score is 80%, which I actually think is shockingly high.
Yeah, that was shocking.
For a movie that I did like, but generally, like, I'll like something like that and look and see, like, oh, yeah, it's got, like, a, you know, 60% or something. I think those should be reversed. Like, I can see how The Monkey is not for everybody, but, and it's only got, like, a 77% critic score, but I don't see how it's, how it's that, like, Hard Eyes, which I haven't seen, has an 81% critic score. And I mean, I don't know, maybe Hard Eyes is great, but what aren't people seeing? Like, I don't know. I don't get it. I think this is absolutely brilliant. And like I said, so damn close to perfect. For me, literally the only thing in the movie that I stepped back and was like, ah, like, maybe you should have thought of something a little bit. I get where you're going. It is the bee thing. Like, it is shocking. Yeah. It is wild. But I don't think the effect, I don't think the shot of the bees going into his mouth, I don't think that works. I think it's for a movie that has so much practical, it doesn't work for me. And like, that bumps it from, like, I think I maybe gave it like an 8 out of 10 on my whatchamacallit rating. But yeah, that Letterbox. I think, like, that's the thing that keeps it from being a 9. And, you know, honestly, like, it might be a 9 out of 10. It might be an 8. It might be closer to an 8.5 out of 10 for me. Like, I need to rewatch it, but the movie, it doesn't misstep at all. Like, every shot is, it's like Wes Anderson in a way, where it's like every shot seems so meticulously created. Like, mm-hmm. every cut is so purposeful. Like, there's literally, like, the movie cuts mid-argument at one point in this movie to just a funeral.
Yes.
And that's fucking, it's hysterical. Like, when it happens, it's just like, oh my God.
No, absolutely. God. Like, it's just, there's so many good things about it. It's like it's a wellspring of just, like, it's just a wellspring of, like, just fucking, like, gifts that keep on giving. Like, yeah. it literally feels like it's, the deck is so stacked that you're not going to get it the first time, right? Like, it's going to take a couple of viewings to, like, really kind of get a grapple on it, even though we're talking about it, like, you know, and it's been, like, you know, close to an hour now that we've been talking about it. It still feels like there is so much more that we're missing that we just haven't gotten to yet, because we haven't had the time to sit with it, right? Like, and truly sit with it, not just like sit with it for a couple of weeks like I have, but like truly kind of like let a few years go by and actually see where it kind of settles in on, because, like, you know, it's one thing to watch a movie once, it's another thing to watch it a few times. And then over the deck, like over a couple of years, and have it ruminate and sit there and swell and stuff. I feel like this is the kind of movie that's going to echo through years and not just sit there. Like, it's built to stay. It's not like a lot of these other things that are just kind of like, nah, we're going to forget about it in 2 years. Like, this is something that we're going to remember in 5-10 years and go, yeah, you know what? No matter what I said about, like, what was the best film of 2025, like, I think The Fucking Monkey is, like, the best film of 2025. I just rewatched it. And fuck. Did we sleep on it? And then it'd be like, no, we didn't sleep on it. But, you know, yeah, it just is grown in esteem. Like, there's certain movies that just grow, right? Like, I was listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about 1999 as a film year, and the movie that they talked about and how much, like, how big of a cultural, like, nuclear bomb, like a nuclear weapon it was American Beauty. But you think about that movie now, 26 years later, nobody's fucking talking about that movie. Nobody gives a shit about that movie. But at the time, it won so many goddamn Oscars. You know, it won as many as Cuckoo's Nest, right? Like, it won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Actress. But, you know, and the podcasters were making a very salient point, which is regardless if Kevin Spacey is in it or not, it still would be a puff of a movie now because it just didn't grow with the culture.
Like,
I mean,
1999 specifically, like, you're right. In that year, it was like, that was the movie. But, like, if you look back on 99, if I were to say movies like The Blair Witch Project, lasting impact, The Mummy has come back around so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's stuff like that that's like at the time, like, yeah, it's kind of a big hit. And yeah, it spawned a bunch of sequels that, and it kind of like just pissed itself away. But like, you can talk to people now and they're like, oh yeah, The Mummy, like, that's like something.
That's the movie. Man. That's their
like,
movie.
That, you know? Like, I loved that movie. The 99 was pretty good year for Love of the Game was 99. Like,
The Insider. Yeah.
Was Phantom Menace 99?
Huh?
Phantom Menace was 99, right?
Yep. Phantom Menace was 99. Three Kings.
Galaxy Quest. That's a good example of like,
Galaxy Quest.
Did okay. Didn't make a ton of money. But
no?
You talk about Galaxy Quest now and people are like, oh shit. Like, it's not that we slept on Galaxy Quest. It's just that it was not truly, truly appreciated when it came out. And now it's like, oh yeah, The Iron Giant. That's another one. In 99, like, didn't make a ton of money. People that saw it were like, this is brilliant. And now it is just this cultural, like, touchstone of, like, everybody, like, because it's the home video market really is what, you know, because everybody saw it on home video and was like, oh shit, this is amazing. You know, that's what happened with Shawshank. I hope this movie makes another $100 million for him. I don't know that it will, but I mean, hell, we thought Captain America was only going to be a moderate success, and it looks like it's going to be pretty successful for Marvel. So I can't wait to see what else he does this year, especially with Tatiana. Osgood Perkins definitely on my radar now. Gonna have to go back and watch Long Legs, if not everything else he's done, and completely rethinking the fucking career of Theo James, because holy shit, he's brilliant. Like, he's so I don't good. Know if it's just the right combination of material, actor, and director, but damn, he is good.
He really is. He's so good in that movie.
I am so happy that I, like, I don't know, this movie just made me happy. As weird as that sounds. Like, I was excited about Captain America and I enjoyed it, but this was, I guess, pleasant surprise. Like, there's nothing better than, like, I hope this is good, and being like, oh shit, this is excellent.
Yes. No, absolutely. Like, to be surprised by something like this, like, is always the best treat of a film year, is when you get an unexpected, like, pop of a film. And this is, like, definitely like it's not even a pop. I don't even know what to call this. Like, it's one of those things where I was like, I was not expecting in February to see a great movie, and it's like truly a great movie. Yeah. So
I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. Spider-Man for sure, if Adam catches up to it.
I definitely will.
And I don't know. Are you watching White Lotus?
No, I mean, I started the other season, and so, like, I'm slowly starting to, like, it's a lot. Like, it's a lot. It's, like, shitty rich humans being shitty.
Yeah. But it's fun. I think I'm just like, going to forego watching season one and two. And
because
just
of the Goggins?
And just jump to season three because, like, I cannot have enough Walton Goggins, and also, Stephanie, my new lady friend, is also a big Walton Goggins fan. So, has never seen Justified.
Oh,
so
that's a field to jump into.
It came up the other day. We were talking about Walton Goggins, and I was like, "Have you ever seen Justified?" And she was like, "No," and I was like, "What?" You gotta watch Justified if you like.
Exactly.
I mean, you gotta watch The Shield too, but you really gotta watch Justified, man.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, that's, like I said, that's a treat. Looking forward to a treat of all treats, man.
Yeah, it is. It's. I mean, you get Walton Goggins and you get Timothy Oliphant.
Yep.
I think I'm gonna talk her into just jumping in. Like, because the seasons only connect tangentially, right?
Season one and two really do, but other than that, like, I've heard that this is
kind of like American Horror Story, where it's like, you can, like, there's references to things, but, like, you know, you don't have to have seen it. I think, because I know episode two of the new season's tomorrow night, so I think that might be something, you know, so maybe I'll get to talk about White Lotus, and who knows what else. I don't know. Anyway, go check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com, or you can check out our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieowl.com, where I've got a ton of stuff that's just posted. A lot of home video content, of course. My review of The Monkey, and you could read that there. It's currently on the boards, but got a lot of good stuff coming up this week as well. Like a particular shark movie from 1999 that's getting a 4K release fairly soon. I just finished. I started my review of, and should be up early next week. So if you know that movie, you will know it. But it's Deepest Darkest, I think. My head is a shark then? I don't know. You'll have to see. You'll have to see. There's a lot more stuff. There's a lot more stuff on the site.
Yeah, and we will see you guys next week.
Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but they're really all sold out. See it all together if you're with me now.